ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, April the 4th. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Israel's under increasing pressure after it admitted killing seven aid workers in Gaza, including Australian Zomi Frankum. The United States President Joe Biden says he's outraged and heartbroken. Three of those killed were British, and UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is being urged to stop arms sales to Israel. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese will join us shortly. Israeli Defence Force sources have told Israeli media the attack happened because commanders disobeyed orders. Israel's PM Benjamin Netanyahu says it was an unintentional mistake and a full inquiry is being held. Palestinian, British, Polish and American Canadian citizens were also among those killed. They all worked for the World Central Kitchen charity. The organisation's founder, celebrity chef Jose Andreas, says the Israeli military needs to answer for what's happened.
At the time, this looks like it's not a war against terrorism anymore. Seems this is a war against humanity itself. You cannot be destroying every building. You cannot be destroying every hospital, every school. You cannot be targeting humanitarian. You cannot be targeting children. You cannot be fighting the basis of what humanity should be standing for.
ABC correspondent Lauren Day is in Jerusalem. Lauren, Israel's promising a thorough inquiry to prevent a repeat of this. What more do we know?
Well, Sabra, Israel has released the preliminary findings from that investigation that's concluded that the attack was a mistake that followed a misidentification at night during a war in very complex conditions. Now, they didn't say how that misidentification happened, given that the convoy was clearly marked with World Central Kitchen logos, and they didn't address the fact that the organisation said that it had, in fact, coordinated with the Israeli military precisely to prevent something like what happened. Now, Israel has promised transparency in this investigation, and no doubt, given the strong comments from international leaders, they'll expect nothing but transparency.
Well, as you say, there's been condemnation. Israel's key allies are quite angry. Is Israel listening?
Well, I think it would be hard for Israel to ignore them at this point. Israel's finding itself increasingly isolated on the world stage. And if they don't listen, they risk antagonising some of their closest allies. A government spokesperson said today that this was a very complex war situation, that war's difficult, it's messy, it's dangerous, and it has casualties. But it said that, having said that, Israel has been checking itself every day, reviewing its actions, and also looking into how they can better distribute aid. They mentioned the new centre that they've set up to help coordinate all the aid between the agencies and the military. But as I said, this was already a coordinated operation, so it's unclear if that new centre will make any difference.
Some charities have paused their operations in Gaza while they reassess the security there. Is aid actually getting through?
Well, yes, that's right. The Israeli strike has dealt a massive blow to the effort to get humanitarian aid to Gazans who were in desperate need. And in some parts, they're on the brink of famine. The World Central Kitchen had become a really central part of that aid effort. It's now suspended its operations. And there's this awful situation now where some 240 tonnes of this desperately needed food supplies have been sent back to Cyprus because there was nobody there to distribute it. The UN has also suspended its aid movements at night while it evaluates the security situation. So this is just a devastating setback for the people of Gaza at a time when there were already issues with humanitarian aid reaching them.
That's Lauren Day there in Jerusalem. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, joins us now from Sydney. Prime Minister, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
The Spanish Prime Minister says Israel's explanation of what's happened is insufficient and unacceptable. Do you share those thoughts?
I certainly do. We need a full, transparent and clear explanation for how this occurred. People would have seen the footage of the vehicle that was hit in this strike by an Israeli missile that clearly is identified as being from the World Central Kitchen. These vehicles were going about carrying the best of humanity, people who'd come from all over the world to help Palestinians who are suffering from extraordinary deprivation in Gaza, and for them to lose their life in these circumstances is outrageous and completely unacceptable. Humanitarian workers are protected under international law, and the Netanyahu government must publish a full and transparent investigation, and they must be held accountable.
Israel says a preliminary investigation says it's a case of misidentification, but IDF sources have told Israeli media it happened because commanders disobeyed orders. Have you had further contact from Israel about exactly what's happened?
I had a discussion with Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday morning where he accepted the responsibility on behalf of the Israeli government for this tragedy. But we need to know exactly how this occurred. One of the things that Israel says is that it is protecting people's lives, innocent people. Well, this stands in stark contrast, as well as, of course, the many incidents affecting not just people who've come from overseas to provide aid, but of course Palestinians themselves, where we've seen extraordinary loss of life in Gaza. And for Israel to be continuing to assert that it will have a ground invasion of Rafah has led to the international community expressing our extreme concern, leading to the United Nations Security Council making the extraordinary resolution that they did just a week ago, that was, of course, not vetoed by the United States.
Zomi Frankham's family says that they'd support a war crimes investigation. The Australian Muslim Advocacy Network says that you should be advocating for an international criminal court investigation now, saying that Israel cannot investigate itself. Will you do that?
We will take advice on an appropriate way forward. We await a full and transparent explanation. Firstly, from Israel about what has occurred here and the circumstances. I certainly understand that Zomi's family have been devastated by this news. I spoke to Zomi's family, her brother, the day before yesterday, after this tragedy occurred, and they're very proud of what Zomi was contributing through her life was about making humanity better. And for her to lose her life with this devastating impact, not just of Zomi, of course, she was one of seven aid workers, but in addition to that, the drivers, the Palestinian man who was driving the car, to lose their life in this way is completely unacceptable, and we do need a full investigation and proper accountability. Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu has assured me on behalf of the Australian government that that would occur, and we need to ensure that the Israeli government is held to account for the commitments that they've made.
You're giving a speech to a small business conference in Sydney this morning and telling them that cost of living relief for families and small business will be a priority in next month's budget. The government delivered bill relief with energy prices last year with state governments. Can people expect that same level of relief this year?
We delivered relief in a way that assisted 5 million Australians and assisted small businesses, and that had a positive impact on not just on them, but also on lowering inflation. So we are going through our budget processes at the moment through the Expenditure Review Committee. Our priority has been cost of living relief. That's why we intervene to ensure that every Australian taxpayer will get a tax cut. But we're also looking at what we can do to provide further cost of living relief without putting pressure on inflation.
But should people expect maybe the same level of relief, or should their expectations not be so high?
We're examining what we can do in the context of a budget, making sure as well that we do put that downward pressure on inflation. We are seeing some positive signs. We've seen inflation moderating. We're seeing real wages increase. We're seeing continued economic growth, unemployment at just 3.7%. So there are some positive signs there, but we understand as well that some people are doing it tough, and that we need to always, what a Labor government will do is always look at ways in which we can provide support for people, and that's the process we're going through at the moment. Our cost of living relief priorities included energy price relief plan last year, and that did have a positive impact. We, of course, will be talking with state and territory governments as well, but we want to provide support for individuals, but also particularly for small business.
You made a promise before the 2022 election that Australians would get $275 in savings and power bills by 2025. Will this budget deliver on that? And it's a promise that you made after the Ukraine war had started.
We know that the world has had the biggest energy price shock in 50 years. That was something that wasn't anticipated. Now, the ongoing war on Ukraine as a result of Russia's illegal invasion and breaching of international law has been one of the factors that has fed into that. That's one of the things that governments right around the world have been dealing with. We have been dealing with it. If you look at the latest Australian Energy Market Operator default market offer, that was much lower than what was occurring last year. So there are some positive signs, but we know that there's more work to do.
You're opening a new mega interstate terminal at the Moorebank in Western Sydney today. In the past, some critics feared that this would be a white elephant. Why does it matter to the rest of Australia?
Oh, look, this is one of the most important infrastructure projects that Australia has seen. It's something that arose from recommendations from Infrastructure Australia when I was the Infrastructure Minister, and some were cynical about it. But what it's done with the duplication of the Southern Sydney Freight Line is open up an interstate terminal which will be the largest intermodal in Australia. This is important about how we build a resilient, efficient and sustainable national supply chain. This first interstate train that will arrive there today signals a new era for rail in Australia. And why that matters is that it lifts productivity, it boosts jobs, particularly in Western Sydney. The terminal will save around 3,000 truck journeys a day on Sydney's roads. It will be Australia's first major metropolitan independent interstate terminal. It operates under an open access arrangement, so it's not controlled by a single existing entity, and that means that there'll be major efficiency. It will help the movement of rail freight between our cities and our regions. It will drive efficiency and competition and economic growth. This is a very exciting development. And in addition to that, the whole project is being run on renewable energy, saving around about 110,000 tonnes of carbon emissions every year.
All right, Prime Minister, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much, Sabra.
As we just heard, the federal government is considering additional help to families in next month's budget, but many communities have already taken it upon themselves to find solutions, stepping away from traditional trade to swap goods and services with each other to get by. And for one woman, it put a roof over her head. Michael Black has more.
Avril Fink's slice of paradise lies in the Bega Valley on the New South Wales south coast.
Well, this is just the mud brick, the compressed block.
It's a mud brick house, sourced from local earth 30 years ago. In just 3 months, 30-odd members of the community helped build the house, with Avril paying for the labour using Bega's local economic trading scheme, or the LETS system, an off-grid economy which trades in sapphires.
It might be imaginary currency, basically swapping time, but it was accounted for by using what was known as sapphires.
To pay down her debt of nearly 30,000 saffs, Avril gave back to her community, gardening, teaching, even wedding planning.
It is covering that ground in between doing things for money and just doing favours, sort of in between love and money. It's the perfect middle ground.
Some are revitalising the sapphire economy for the next generation. Sue Andrew moved to the country in the early noughties, buying a small property in nearby Woolloomla, which she re-stumped using SAFs, quite literally giving her a foundation in the community.
For me, the biggest thing was the friendships, because we'd moved here from Sydney, my partner and I, and we didn't know many people. And through the LETS system, we got to know heaps of people and like-minded people.
But there are those who aren't like-minded, wondering why they should give up their time or who worry about being grifted.
I've never seen it get exploited, because I found the people that tend to be involved in it are almost like people that would be part of a gift economy even if they were.
There are nearly 30 LETS schemes across Australia, the newest ones starting after the Black Summer bushfires or during the pandemic.
The overriding thing was wanting to help people or feel part of something bigger than themselves.
Dr. Madeline Taylor has spent 2 years researching the explosion of online gift economies in recent years. There are nearly 700 Buy Nothing Facebook groups across Australia, where local communities give away free goods to their neighbours. And there's an estimated 1 million households taking part, including Dr. Taylor's young family.
I'm looking for ways to see hope for our future in terms of, you know, sustainability, in terms of climate change, in terms of feeling less atomised as a community.
It's that final point which Dr. Taylor sees as one of the ways these groups could make for a kinder community.
The other thing that I think really needs to change, and this is a kind of product of our current society, is people feeling comfortable with asking for help.
That's Dr. Madeline Taylor from Queensland University of Technology, Andy Michael Black's report. And you can find more on that story, including an in-depth interview with Avril Fink and the house that the LETS scheme built, on my new podcast, The Bright Side. You can find it on the ABC Listen app today. Australians heading to Bali could face random checks by tourism police as authorities apply a new $15 visitor tax. The province has introduced the new charge to discourage troublemakers from visiting. With more, here's Indonesia correspondent Bill Birtles.
On a perfect afternoon at Uluwatu Temple, one of Bali's must-see spots, hundreds of tourists are flowing in. But a team of khaki-clad tourism police are there to greet them, shaking them down for $15.
Have you paid it at the airport?
At the airport, no. I don't.
Some tourists are one step ahead.
Yes, I knew before I left home. That's why we prepaid it before we left.
Others have no idea about the new levy.
The what? Do you know about it?
Oh, I'll just pay whatever's coming through, mate.
The tourism tax was first announced last year after a series of viral videos emerged showing foreign tourists behaving badly in Bali. A naked German woman busting in the doors of a temple during a dance performance, Russian Instagrammers posing naked at holy sites, and an Australian getting caught for stealing erectile dysfunction pills from a pharmacy. Ikatit Nyadnya from the Bali Tourism Office says authorities devised a two-step response. Firstly, with a list on how to behave.
We have what we call do and don't for tourists, what they can do, what they cannot do in Bali.
He says the new tax is about managing the burden of more than 5 million foreign visitors a year.
So we want to conserve our culture and also preserve our nature, because the main attraction of Bali tourism is culture and nature. So to conserve them, we need some money.
In recent months, there have been fewer reports of bad behaviour by tourists, but other problems like plastic rubbish washing up on beaches remain. Local politician and rubbish clean-up activist Wayan Pusban Negara hopes the tourist tax will help.
And we hope from that tourist levy can use that money for take care, especially for the rubbish in Bali. And we predict if the tourist levy is effective, our rubbish in Bali can be reduced.
Bali's foreign tourism numbers are yet to reach the 6 million a year that the island had before the COVID pandemic. And some locals think a $15 levy on top of a $50 visa fee is sending the wrong message. But the so-called Island of the Gods is like a second home to many Australians. And regular visitor Damien Tout from Melbourne says the extra fee won't stop him coming back.
No, not at all. Could be another $50, we wouldn't care. We'd still come to Bali.
On Kuta Beach in Bali, this is Bill Birtles reporting for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Israel says it was a mistake. But how does a military manage to bomb a clearly marked aid convoy? Today, a longtime aid worker, Tim Costello, on why no one trying to deliver aid in Gaza is safe and what the world should do about it. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.